Thanks. You may be seated. Well, this morning I've entitled my message, God in the House, because it's all about inviting, having God kind of among us and in our house. I'll move out of the way so these guys can put the table up here. I've got a number of things on this table that just hopefully will help us in a visible way kind of remember what we're talking about this morning. I've got some house building materials or some house building tools, a hammer and a measuring tape. Don't worry, I won't use any of this morning. But it's there's a very practical psalm about house building and kind of it contrasts house and home. It talks about house and home and how we live that out. It talks about some of the intrinsic values and benefits of building and working. And it also talks about the value and intrinsic good about our children and about our homes. And I think it's incredibly relevant at this time of the year. And so this is a Psalm 127 that I'll read, and then we'll kind of explore a little bit about what its practicality is to us. It says in Psalm 127, it says, "Unless the Lord builds a house, the work of the builders is wasted. Unless the Lord protects a city, guarding it with sentries will do no good. It is useless for you to work so hard." Ever felt that way? It's useless to work so hard. "From early morning until late at night, anxiously working for food to eat, for God gives rest to his loved ones." And it says in verse 3, "Children are a gift from the Lord. They are a reward from him. Children born to a young man are like arrows in a warrior's hands. How joyful is the man whose quiver is full of them. He will not be put to shame when he confronts his accusers at the city gates." An incredibly practical passage about work and home and family. And sometimes finding balance in the middle of that, and especially at this time of the year, can be quite a challenging thing. And you might not be in kind of the raising kids kind of phase of things. You might be kind of coming back off of vacation and going back to the grind. Or maybe it's something that you really look forward to. I love my work and I just want to jump in and enjoy it and grow in it and learn more. And whatever phase of life, this passage really talks about balance. And how do you love your job, jump into your job, and also kind of love the relationships around you. So no matter what phase of life you might be in this morning, you might be going, "Oh, I'm back to school. Gotta do that work again." Or but we are a very success-driven, kind of work-orientated society. And sometimes we can get this out of balance. And workaholism, I think it's kind of fell into more disrepute recently, but there was kind of, you know, the Protestant work ethic and kind of, you know, people have started to see sometimes that, you know, to live to work might be a little much. And then we can swing the balance over and go, "Well, I'm just working to live and, you know, just whatever happens in work." And I think this passage brings some balance to it. So this passage doesn't have a lot to say about the person who doesn't want to work. There's other passages that talk about that. Solomon, who wrote this, he also wrote large passages of Proverbs. And he talks about a person who's lazy, who just doesn't want to work at all, who doesn't want to build anything or do anything. And he says, you know, it's a person who's always making excuses. And this is Proverbs 26, verse 13, which is just a funny proverb. It's a person who says, he says, "The lazy person claims there's a lion on the road. Yes, I'm sure there's a lion out there." You know, he doesn't want to go out and work because I'm sure something's going to happen to me if I go out there. To that kind of person, Solomon just says, get a job. Go get some work, you know, get there. But there is the other end of the extreme where there's a person who's just struggling with workaholism and with doing that all at the expense of everything else. And, you know, two psychologists, they've founded a whole psychology kind of field, is Minerth and Meyer. And this is what they say about it. "The selfishness of the perfectionist workaholic is much more subtle. While he or she is out in society saving humanity at a work pace of 80 to 100 hours a week, he or she is selfishly ignoring the spouse and children. He is burying his emotions and working like a computerized robot. He helps mankind partially out of love and compassion, but mostly out of an unconscious compensation for his insecurity, and as a means to fulfilling both his strong need for society's approval and his driving urge to be perfect. He is self-critical and deep within himself feels inferior. He feels like a nobody and spends the bulk of his life working at a frantic pace to prove to himself that he is really not, as he suspects deep within him, a nobody. In his own eyes and in the eyes of society is the epitome of human dedication. He becomes angry with his wife and children's place he becomes angry when his wife and children place demands on him. He can't understand how they could have the nerve to call such an unselfish, dedicated servant a selfish husband and father. In reality, his wife and children are correct. They are suffering severely because of his subtle selfishness. Okay, strong words about kind of finding that way out of line, kind of balance that obviously we don't want to go there. So this proverb speaks to how to redeem work, how to approach work in a way that God would want us to kind of take it on. And one of the first things that we see in the first phrase of that psalm is, unless the Lord builds a house, the work of the builders is wasted. And the first point that we can get from this is, it is so important for us to involve God in our work. There's strong words here. It says, actually, work is wasted if it's done apart from God. If it's about priorities that are out of line, if it's about prestige, if it's about just having somehow this strong sense of need to kind of validate oneself, saying, you know what, it's ultimately wasted. I think it's important for all of us to kind of look at our approach to work and say, God, what is it? Why am I working? What is, to use the Alpha Course, what is the meaning of this? And the Bible has this incredible perspective on work where it says, you know what, if you do it for God, if you do it with God involved in it, if you say, you know, ultimately I'm doing this for his glory, and we can approach it with a sense of excellence, we can approach it with our efforts saying, you know, ultimately I may be doing this for a boss or to get that paycheck at the end of the month, but actually I'm not. I'm actually doing this for God. And his acclaim and his notice is what I'm really doing this for. It changes our perspective on it. And it gives meaning, it gives purpose to it, because we say, you know what, God, you're honored by something that is done well. You are honored by being of service to other people. And you're honored through my efforts here on this earth to redeem this earth. And sometimes it feels like we're working in this fallen, broken world, and there's a part of work that's just toil and labor, and that's part of the brokenness of this world. But there's this kind of sense that if we go into it and we say, God, I want to involve you in it. I recognize that you're already at work. I'm working with you. I'm working for you. It changes everything. You know, it was interesting. This last week, if you've turned on the TV, obviously there's lots of news about 9/11 and about the World Trade Center. And I appreciated Peter's prayer this morning for us to remember that in a very sober kind of a way, obviously, about just the tragedy of the loss of life there. I watched an interesting documentary this last week on public television that was about kind of the building of those towers and the dreams of both the architect and those that were behind it with the New York Port Authority. And there was one man especially kind of driving that within the city there at the time and getting, you know, the permits. And the whole idea was, and it was for a time, the two tallest buildings in the world. And it trumped the Empire State Building, and shortly afterwards, the Sears Tower in Chicago went higher. But this was in the 60s and early 70s. And it was interesting, they chronicled the life of the guy who was kind of behind the whole thing, whose dream it was to build these towers, and who was just worked furiously. It was like, it was everything to him. And he managed to get it off the ground and get it going. But it was right during that kind of post-Vietnam recession time. New York had never been more crime-ridden and dirty. And people were just like, this is the worst thing to be undertaking at this time. And what this man thought would be so much, would get him so much acclaim within, you know, one of the world's most prominent cities. Actually, public opinion was hugely against those towers going up. They thought they were ugly. The design was wrong. It was a wrong priority of spending. they were wasting all sorts of money. And ultimately, when the buildings were built, the economy was in such a deep hole that it mostly had to be government offices in the floors, and tons of it was unused. It was an interesting thing. Eventually, it did change, and the whole economy picked up, and as you know, New York took off. But it was interesting to see kind of what happened to this fellow. They talked about his broken spirit, somehow wanting so much the acclaim and the prestige that came with building that, but finding that all he had was problems and heartache and nightmare, and he died a very broken man, as this portrayed it anyhow. And you can see that it was very much a picture of, unless the Lord builds a house, your time is wasted. And we may not be involved in something nearly that grandiose, but whatever it is that we kind of put ourselves into, I think it's important to say, God, can you guide and direct me? Can this be for you? And to sort of look at our motives, and to look at our motives too and say, am I doing this for God? Or am I doing this just for my own need for approval? Or my own acclamation in front of others? Or for my own power? Or am I so consumed with kind of the bigger and better and the need of things that are temporal? And God says, you know what? There's a much bigger picture. And when we take that bigger picture, it frees us. Now, some people would say, well, just do your work and get it done and then move on with God. And God says, you know what? Actually, there's no separation between the sacred and the secular. Some people kind of compartmentalize their lives and say, you know, this is what I do for God, and this is what's important, this is what I don't do for God. I remember having a conversation with a buddy of mine in high school, and it just kind of came about, but I don't know. I wasn't that spiritual, but he was a guy that I worked in youth ministry with, and we had a great youth ministry kind of thing going, and we just loved our youth pastor. We just poured our hearts into it and that whole thing, and he did too. But when it came to work, it was like, don't give a rip about this, you know, kind of thing. And I mentioned this verse, and it actually kind of made him go, oh, I didn't know that was in there. It says in Colossians 3, verse 23, work willingly at whatever you do, as though you were working for the Lord rather than for people. And it changed it. And he actually totally changed his direction and went, oh, okay, this is part of my life, doing my work at school. This is for God. This isn't something that's completely separated and wasted. And that's the wonderful thing about saying, you know what, God, I want to put my energies into pleasing you. I want to do this for you. And how I go about doing this matters. Integrity matters. Discipline matters. Honesty at work. If I'm involved in business, doing it right and as a service to people. If I'm involved in whatever it might be, God, you can use this. And I think God kind of shows us what that is. How do we go about that? And to do it in such a way that it's not so all-consuming that we've still got balance for, and in the midst of it, relationships matter. People matter. When Suzanne and I were just getting started in our first house, I remember moving into our first house a few years after we were married, and ended up talking over the fence with my neighbor. He's just a great guy, and you know, you're excited, you got this house, and you're sharing how the details of it came together with, you know, your new neighbor and everything, and all of a sudden he just paused for a moment. He sort of got reflective. He says, don't make paying off your house your only goal. He says, we did that. 10 years later, we've paid off the house, but I feel like I missed out on so many things with my kids. And it was good words. And sometimes we do things all at the expense of something else. And I think it's really important for us to say, if I'm doing it for God, he's going to direct me as to how to do this in the right way, with the right priorities. So involve God in your work. And sometimes very practically, it's just the beginning of the day, in the morning, it might become a habit as you drive to work, whatever. God, I'm doing this for you. Can you guide me? Can the results? I'm going to trust the results are up to you. And help me to do this with you in mind and alongside of you. Number two, second phrase there in verse one says, trust God to protect what you have worked for. It says, unless the Lord protects a city, guarding it with sentries will do no good. Now, if ever on a citywide level, we can see that. The illustration is tragically there with New York. We had thought, and I think many Americans thought, that that was completely protected, the anti-terrorism, the American military. And there was just this rattling effect And when that happened 10 years ago, the conversations I had, and I know many of us experienced and felt deep within, is, my goodness, this can happen that close to home? Like, we kind of thought our society, our economy, and everything was very secure. And it was sort of a shakeup. Like, and at that point, we didn't know where the economy would go or what things kind of would go from there. The government just encouraged us to spend more, and we see where that's gotten us. But there is ultimately no guarantees. There's no guarantees about the protection and the security of our futures. And it's very good to plan for the future. It's very good to set up things that would secure us. I've got, as an example here, just an RSP statement, it's a very small amount of mine, that goes in, you know, that we do. And that's a good thing. But we know, even recently with what's happened in the economy, that there's no guarantees on that, too. That can kind of fall apart. I've got some keys here with a fob that we use for getting into the school here. We have alarms on our houses. We know, ultimately, those aren't guarantees either. And this reminds us that, you know what? Ultimately, our approach, what can change things so much in terms of the worry and the anxiousness that sometimes we feel, is to say, God, this stuff's yours. I hold this with an open hand. I'm going to hold on to you tightly. And all of this stuff, though we're going to do the right things to secure and protect and think about the future, it's ultimately up to you. There's a freedom in that. There's an incredible kind of guarantee that God says to us. He says, you know what? I'll look after you. And it changes our perspective on life. It really does. It says in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 to 21, this is Jesus. He knew the kind of anxiousness that we would feel in our spirits about things and stuff. He says, don't store up treasures here on earth where moths eat them and rust destroys them and where thieves break in and steal. Store your treasures in heaven where moths and rust cannot destroy and thieves do not break in and steal. Wherever your treasure is, there the desires of your heart will also be. You know, where our thoughts kind of go to in our downtime oftentimes indicates what is most important to us. And I know that things are stuff that God has given us things to enjoy. And he has given us people and relationships to enjoy. But he's saying to us, too, if we can kind of say, you know what, God, I'm going to put my heart on you. I'm going to hold on to you tightly. I'm going to kind of think about what your perspective is. And I'm going to kind of put myself in a place where I can learn more about how you view the world. I'm going to kind of take that step back. And that can be very challenging in the midst of the busyness of life. And I know if you're running a young family or anything, this is the busiest time of the year. But it changes how we commit, what we commit to, what we get involved in, what we say yes to and we say no to. It affects all those things if we say, you know what, God, ultimately I know that this stuff passes. But this relationship with you, this is what I want to lean in on. This is what I want to grow in. And we say, God, I'm going to trust you with the stuff and with what the future holds as well. And that can be an incredibly comforting thing when we look at the news and all the volatility and all that's happening in the world. There's an incredible peace that can happen in that. Then the next verse just follows right along with that. It says, it's useless for you to work so hard from early morning until late at night, anxiously working for food to eat. And in our society, it's oftentimes much more than food. It's kind of all the other creature comforts. God gives rest to his loved ones. Though the word isn't in there, what the psalmist is talking about is that we have a generous God. He's not a stingy God. He's a God who knows what we need and even knows what we want. And he is a God whose heart is generous and big to give towards us. And what this verse is saying is that he gives rest to those he loves. He says, you know, rest. I love you. I'm going to take care of things. You might be at a difficult time in your family or in your own personal life, financially or even relationships. There's something incredible that happens when we say, you know what, God, I'm just going to stop. I'm going to just leave it with you. You might even envision just physically kind of saying, God, here it is. That relationship, that need, that financial pressure that I'm facing. And I want to go about it in a new way, God. Help me to do that. You know, that last phrase in the verse, it was interesting as I was looking into this, and some of the commentary said that actually it can be, you know, the translation on the original Hebrew in this could go, God gives rest to his loved ones, or it could actually read, God gives while his loved ones rest. And either way, I think it's the same meaning. It's like, even while we're resting, well, we got our head on our pillow on our couch, and just for a moment going, you know what, God, you're at work. I can stop, and I can just let you do the work for a time. And sometimes that can be incredibly helpful, both in work, to say, you know what, there's going to be a time when I'm going to cut it off, and even in our families' lives, too. I know sometimes with our kids, we get into this, I got to put them in everything, and I got to keep them busy, and I got to keep going, and sometimes just that discipline of stopping and resting is what we need in order to go, you know what, God, you're actually at work. It's not all up to me. What this is really saying is, it's ultimately not up to me. You might have heard that slogan before, maybe you haven't, but if it's going to be, it's up to me, right? You might have heard that. That's not true. There is a human responsibility in things, but there's limitations. And God made our bodies and made our hearts and minds with limitations and says, it's time to stop. And it might be taking, I've got up here too as an illustration, I've got the read through the Bible in a year kind of thing. And I'm attempting that in a very non-good way. That's not even good. To try and do that. But to just stop and to go, okay, the only way I'm going to get re-perspective is to come out somehow see God's perspective on things. It's the only way we get true north again is to do that. None of us do this perfectly, and it's always a balance act, and there's lots of falling down and not making it. But there are some great kind of people who seem to do this well. Obviously not perfectly, but one of them is a guy I've been kind of interested in recently. I'd never heard of Chick-fil-A restaurants. Anybody here ever been to a Chick-fil-A? Okay, some of you have. I think they're in the southern states. Comes out of Atlanta. The founder of those restaurants is a guy named Truett Sam. Truett Cathy. That's quite a handle. A guy in the southern states who started that. He's 90 years old right now. And I checked him up on Wikipedia. And he started this chain of restaurants called Chick-fil-A. There's, I don't know, a ton of them now. It says here in Wikipedia that he's worth $1.5 billion. Not bad. He's also a Christian. And it says his career, he says he's taught Sunday school for over 50 years at his church there. He has testified that the Bible is his guidebook for life. And as an extension of his convictions, all of the company's locations, whether company-owned or franchised, are closed on Sundays, a rare policy within the food service industry. People estimate that he loses millions of dollars every year by doing that. The reason why he does this is to allow his employees to attend church and spend time with their families. This is a policy that Truett began when he was working 6 days a week, multiple shifts. So the guy worked hard. There's no question about that. But he stopped. He decided to close on Sundays to relax and recharge as well as honor God. The policy remains intact today as the restaurants are closed on Sunday. Interesting thing. So that's how he said it. And God says, yeah, do take a rest. Take a day and shut things down. And so this is what he's done. And it's interesting to see as an extension of that, kind of how he uses what he's been given in resources. He's built these, it talks about wind-shaped homes. These are homes for orphans. And he says there's 11 homes now in the United States, it says, and one in Brazil. And there's also a foundation for scholarships for kids and college students. So along with his kind of perspective on work ends and I'm going to rest, he's also put an incredible amount of effort into the building of children. And it says here too, it says, one of his favorite sayings is, it's easier to build boys and girls than to mend men and women. And I don't think it has to be either or, but he says it's easier to build children than it is to mend adults. And so as a result of that, he's just poured money into this. And it says instead of giving promotional toys at this restaurant, they offer VeggieTales books, cassettes, audio cassettes focused on the family, and other kind of things. And so he's done this, and he actually took in an orphan, a young African-American guy named Woody Falk. And it says here, he gives a good summary of Kathy's character. He says, a lot of people look on Truett as Santa Claus, but he's not. He'll meet you halfway so that you can learn a lesson from the process. He's the personification of James 1:22. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. I sincerely owe my life to that man. This is the kind of impact he's had in this kind of life. It's an incredible thing to kind of get this perspective practically in our lives. And we know we never get it completely right. But there is just an incredible thing of saying, you know what? There's this, and then there's the work of my family as well. And that's the next verses here. It says, children are a gift from the Lord. They're a reward from him. Children born to a young man, that's my phone. I should remind myself to turn that off. That's really distracting. Children born to a young man are like arrows in a warrior's hands. How joyful is a man whose quiver is full of them. He will not be put to shame when he confronts his accusers at the city gates. I've got a picture here of my clan, my family, my brothers, my sisters, my parents. And the point is, there's relationships in our lives. And you may not have a big clan. And in some ways, you know what God intends the church to be is that spiritual family. But regardless, the relationships that are there, God says, I want you to lean in on those. And it's interesting that some people have said they think that these are two psalms, this one on work and this one on family and children. And they're separate things. But in fact, I think it's really a progression. It talks about work and then it talks about children. And in work, you work for wages and you get what you earn kind of thing. But it's saying, in contrast, children are really a gift. And we know that. And without going into all the procreation and conception kind of stuff, we recognize that it's ultimately a gift. And children are a gift. God is ultimately sovereign in that process. And when we're given a gift of children, God says, I want you to value that. And realize that life, in fact, all of life, is a grace. There is things in this world that we say we earn and we do, but it's ultimately just a grace. And when we can learn to receive and give grace in our families, and I think when we realize that they're gifts and that how we interact with them is all about giving and helping them to understand and learn what grace is like in life, we build great homes. And you may not have children, and they may not be at home, but we have parents as well. And there's a way of doing this in our relationships that we go, you know what, I want to be a gift of grace to that other person. And that's really what this is talking about, is saying when you live that way, it's like you're like a warrior. You've got like this full life. It says God's saying to us here, live that way. Live life as a grace. And I think it's important for us, even at this time of the year, and maybe you like us, has got kids going off to school and you're running every way, am I living it in a gracious way? Or is it in a kind of a frantic, kind of a demanding sort of way? How do I live it out with my kids? How do I really show them that they're valued? That may not be in putting them in every kind of thing and making them work so hard, whether, you know, the things that we think are great programs. It might be just stopping and sometimes resting and maybe putting our heads on the pillow in the living room and just talking. Or making room for growing in a relationship with God. Whatever it is, I think it's important. These verses talks about how joyful is a person who just kind of recognizes this grace and lives in it. Second point along with that is enjoy your family stage. This one's talking about that initial, the young man, the young woman, just starting off, and you saw that in the Alpha video. But we go through these phases. You might be in the baby stage. You might be in the toddler, the preschool, the elementary school, the high school, the college. Whatever the stage is, live and enjoy in that. Enjoy that stage while you're there, because it moves so quickly. Our family had an opportunity to kind of see that this last week. Big, big kind of change. And some of you have got kids just going into school, or you just started with a new baby. Our big thing was we sent our oldest off to college this week. And on Tuesday, we ended up at the airport there. There's a picture. Saying goodbye to him. And, you know, it's kind of a very, very, it's a really bizarre experience. Because it says, you just know that this is how it should be. There's this wonderful thing of just sending them off. I get my car back. But there's that part of you, so you know that things are always, they're going to be different forever. And it's as it should be. But you recognize that it went by so fast from this stage. You got another slide there? There, you know, that's going into that's going in kindergarten. You know, you remember that first time when you walk your kids? Some of you had that this last week. First day of kindergarten. And you realize, okay, there's the big wild world out there. And how did we go from that to the other one? That. It feels like that. It really does. It feels that quick. And, you know, life is a gift. There's time as a gift. And if in this week you can say, you know what, I'm just going to slow things down. I'm going to really enjoy this. Live, that's what this verse is saying. Live that way. Live it out that way. And then I'm going to wrap things up here, but the last part of that verse is a little bit kind of a quandary. What does it mean? He will not be put to shame when he confronts his accusers at the city gates. You know, the interesting thing is back in, you know, ancient Near Eastern times, the way that you would secure some of your, or be looked after when you're older, was through your children, through those who would take care of you. They didn't have, you know, some of the old age pension or RSPs that we have today and things like that. But when somebody would want to prey upon the vulnerable, upon the old, the children would stand up for them. And though our situation may be somewhat changed, although there might be lots of similarities today where we stand by our parents in their old age, it's a good reminder that as the passages of life change, there is something joyful and good about caring for our parents as they get older. And to bless our parents, to bless our families this way. And to look after them, to make sure that they're not left vulnerable or uncared for or even relationally alone during the older years. That's what this is about. It's saying, you know what, you can stand for them and with them. And then finally on this, I want to say, keep learning. It's a continual learning process. And I think it's wonderful to know. And, you know, you have these kind of things as you send off a kid to college. You know, how did it go? You look at it and you go, man, messed up there. Didn't learn there or whatever. But you look at it and you say, you know what, God, I can keep learning. I can keep growing. And I don't have to live in the past or live in regrets. I can live looking towards the future. Because, God, you've got something good ahead in this next phase. It's a wonderful thing to keep that learning growing. And just another encouragement, that parenting seminar that we're going to be doing in October, check out the details of that. If you can carve out time for that, there's going to be valuable input about parenting there if you're right in the thick of it right now. Or maybe you've got grandkids and you want to learn a little bit more about that. Whatever it might be, keep learning. Keep lifelong learning. And finally, I think this, as I said, this passage I think is a lot about growing in that balance of work, family, of doing it well. I was thinking about that balancing act, and sometimes you feel like, ah, I fell off to the side this way, or I fell off this way, or it's a bit of a tightrope, and we learn as we go. And it was interesting, as I was thinking about this, I also looked at this other thing, that thing to do with the World Trade Center. There's a guy named Philippe Petit, and he's a tightrope walker. When you're a tightrope walker, you walk with a bar that kind of helps you keep your balance on the high wire. And many of you might remember it. It was interesting. I watched this article and went, in 1974, there's a guy named Philippe Petit, a Frenchman, who strung a wire between the towers, the World Trade Center, 1,368 feet above the ground, a quarter mile above the street below. He decided that he set out, it was actually in the dentist chair, he said that he got this idea to put a cable between the two tallest buildings in the world at the time. This was in the 60s. He worked on it for 6 years as they were being built. In 1974, he managed to, with his buddies, sneak up there numerous times, cache things up there, came across as if he was an architectural engineer, had an interview with the guy who was running it, the Port Authority guy who was running it, who was going, they're asking questions about how much these towers sway and things like that. I thought it was odd, but didn't have any idea that this was what they were up to. And he was a tightrope walker who said, I'm going to walk across that. And sure enough, in August of 1974, they managed to get up there. And in the morning hours, all of a sudden, they used, I guess, an arrow kind of a system to shoot the cable across. And all of a sudden, people were walking to work, and they looked up, and there's this guy walking across the 200-foot span, quarter mile up. I actually remember seeing it in the news. My father pointed it out, and I'm old enough to remember, 1974, when it happened, and he's like, what a nutcase. But the way he described it as I watched this thing on TV this week was like, he said it was the most freeing. I mean, he's a French guy, right? Very romantic kind of way of just, it was the most amazing thing. He talked about doing this. And even they sent police guys up there right away who stood on the side. Well, the cop described it as he danced on the wire. He actually was jumping up and down. He knelt down and saluted. He laid down on the wire. He actually had a conversation with a seagull that was flying overhead at the time. There was this incredible freeing experience that he talked about. And when asked why he did it, he says, when I see three oranges, I juggle. When I see two towers, I walk. So this is how he took on life. Initially, he was slapped with about 40 kind of charges against him, but eventually he dropped all of them. He had to do a benefit tightrope walk across Central Park for some kids. And eventually, they realized that, in fact, he kind of changed the perception of the Twin Towers at the time to something that people embraced and was good, and their public opinion was against it. He was given a free pass, a lifetime free pass at the end of the day, to the observation tower up there, and actually got to have a little bit of a memorial or a plaque towards him up there on one of the beams. You know, in our lives, we might not get that kind of acclaim for holding the balance in work and family and how we go about it. But you know, in God's books, he looks at us and he says, you know what, you're doing well. Like, keep working at it. Keep learning that balance. And we might not feel like we're dancing or jumping in that process, but it's something that God says, you know what, life is ultimately about a grace. And we can all learn and grow in this area. And I'll be there to help you, to empower you. You will be in there. And at the end of the day, you won't say it was wasted. You'll say, God's in the house. He's with me. I want to invite you to stand, and we'll close. Dear God, I just want to thank you that you are there to help us. That really what this psalm is about is just reaching out to you and saying, God, I want you in my work. I want you to guide my priorities. I want you to just purify my motives. I want you to use what I even gather together to be generous, because you're a generous God. You're giving to me even while I'm sleeping, while I'm resting. And I thank you for family. I thank you for the children that you give us. Lord, may we just show them that they're valuable again this week, just through our life, through our pace of life, through our actions, our involvement with them this week. And I thank you, God, that you're there to give us balance in all of these things and to be there to be our guide. I thank you for that. In your name, amen. Well, I hope you have a really good week.